Hey, good evening, everybody. God, this is a little loud, isn't it? Let's try it again. Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, it's Friday night. We're going to try to squeeze in a lot tonight. Sam Cedar will join us in about an hour. Also, we'll be doing, I think, two rounds of podcast trivia. Thanks to Sean. Sean donated 12 podcasts to give away. He donated them with a call to all engineers and scientists to join him in boycotting corporations. You remember I read this a week or so ago when Sean first sent it in. So tonight we will be doing that. We'll give away a couple. And thanks, Sean. We appreciate it very much. This first hour, our first hour sponsor is Russell Chard. He has a message here. He retired one week ago after 32 years as a professional firefighter and proud union member of IAFF Local 1375. Solidarity now and solidarity forever from Russ in Hollywood, Florida. Thanks, Russ. Now, the other thing about this first hour, you've heard me talk about Alice in Arkansas, Helen Hollers. She sponsors quite a bit of the program. And she had bought a sponsorship for the second hour, but I want to move Alice up an hour here. And even though we have a first hour sponsor, Russell C. in Hollywood, Florida, I'm going to add Alice, because what Alice asked me to do was to dedicate her sponsorship to the women who died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire 100 years ago today. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. I'm sure some of you are. You can look it up real quick if you want to. But it was a horrible situation. And as Alice wrote to me, everyone gets very exercised at the jumpers from the World Trade Center, how the godless Muslim terrorists, quote, quote, responsible for all that carnage. But no one remembers the shirtwaist jumpers. No one talks about the wealthy industrialists who were responsible for all those deaths. 146 people died in the Triangle Shirtwaist fire. The youngest was an 11-year-old girl. Most of them were women. A huge number of them were teenagers, and a lot of them were in their 20s. These were immigrants who had gone to work at a factory in lower Manhattan, right? So here we are. 100 years later, and Alice just wanted me to remind everybody about this. As far as her company, Helen Hollers, she is on our website, MikeMalloy.com, and she has some great products. If you want to check it out, I would appreciate it. We're going to start tonight with a commemoration of those people, those women who died 100 years ago, and what resulted from, in terms of legislation and how it was fought tooth and nail by the capitalist bastards even back then. So, there was there was a reporter named William Shepard. He was a United Press reporter who happened to be in Washington Square on March 25th, 1911. And he provided an eyewitness account as to what happened at that fire. He phoned in details while he was watching the tragedy unfold. At the other end of the telephone was Roy Howard. And Howard sat there on a telegraph machine and telegraphed what Shepard was reporting, eyewitness, to the nation's newspapers. The document was first published in the Milwaukee Journal, March 27th, 2 days later, 1911. I was walking through Washington Square when a puff of smoke issuing from the factory building caught my eye. I reached the building before the alarm was turned in. I saw every feature of the tragedy visible from outside the building. I'd learned a new sound, a more horrible sound than description can picture. It was the thud of a speeding, living body on a stone sidewalk. Thud, dead. Thud, dead. Thud, dead. Thud, dead. 62 thud deads. I call them that because the sound and the thought of death came to me each time at the same instant. There was plenty of chance to watch them as they came down. The height of the building was 80 feet. The first 10 thud deads shocked me. I looked up, saw that there were scores of girls at the windows. The flames from the floor below were beating in their faces. Somehow I knew that they too must come down, and something within me, something that I didn't know was there, steeled me. I even watched one girl falling, waving her arms, trying to keep her body upright until the very instant she struck the sidewalk. She was trying to balance herself. Then came the thud. Then a silent, unmoving pile of clothing and twisted, broken limbs. As I reached the scene of the fire, a cloud of smoke hung over the building. I looked up to the seventh floor. There was a living picture in each window, four screaming heads of girls waving their arms. "Call the firemen!" they screamed, scores of them. "Get a ladder!" cried others. They were all as alive and whole and sound as were we who stood on the sidewalk. I couldn't help thinking of that. We cried to them not to jump. We heard the siren of a fire engine in the distance. The other sirens sounded from several directions. "Here they come," we yelled. "Don't jump. Stay there." One girl climbed onto the window sash. Those behind her tried to hold her back. Then she dropped into space. I didn't notice whether those above watched her drop because I had turned away. Then came that first thud. I looked up. Another girl was climbing onto the windowsill. Others were crowding behind her. She dropped. I watched her fall, and again, the dreadful sound. Two windows away, two girls were climbing onto the sill. They were fighting each other and crowding for air. Behind them, I saw many screaming heads. They fell almost together, but I heard two distinct thuds. Then the flames burst out through the windows on the floor below them and curled up into their faces. The firemen began to raise a ladder. Others took out a life net. And while they were rushing to the sidewalk with it, two more girls shot down. The firemen held it under them. The bodies broke it. The grotesque simile of a dog jumping through a hoop struck me. Before they could move the net, another girl's body flashed through it. The thuds were just as loud, it seemed, as if there had been no net there. It seemed to me that the thuds were so loud that they might have been heard all over the city. I counted 10. Then my dulled senses began to work automatically. I noticed things that it had not occurred to me before to notice, little details that the first shock had blinded me to. I looked up to see whether those above watched those who fell. I noticed that they did. They watched them every inch of the way down and probably heard the roaring thuds that we heard. As I looked up, I saw a love affair in the midst of all the horror. A young man helped a girl to the windowsill. Then he held her out deliberately away from the building and let her drop. He seemed cool and calculating. He held out the second girl the same way and let her drop. And then he held out a third girl who did not resist. I noticed that. They were as unresisting as if he were helping them onto a streetcar instead of into eternity. Undoubtedly, he saw that a terrible death awaited them in the flames, and this was only a terrible chivalry. Then came the love amid the flames. He brought another girl to the window. Those of us who were looking saw her put her arms about him and kiss him. Then he held her out into space and dropped her. But quick as a flash, he was on the windowsill himself. His coat fluttered upward. The air filled his trouser legs. I could see that he wore tan shoes and hose. His hat remained on his head. Thud, dead, together. They went into eternity. I saw his face before they covered it. You could see in it that he was a real man. He had done his best. What we're listening to is an eyewitness account of what happened at the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire 100 years ago today. We'll continue after the break.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Alice at Helen Hollers wanted me to make sure that we covered what occurred in this country in Greenwich Village 100 years ago today, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. And what I have here is an eyewitness report from William Shepherd. I happened to be walking through Washington Square on that day and phoned in what he saw. Back to his report. We found out later that in the room in which he stood, many girls were being burned to death by the flames and were screaming in an inferno of flame and heat. He chose the easiest way and was brave enough to even help the girl he loved to a quicker death after she had given him a goodbye kiss. He leaped with an energy as if to arrive first in that mysterious land of eternity, but her thud, dead, came first. The fireman raised the longest ladder. It reached only to the sixth floor. I saw the last girl jump at it and miss it, and then the faces disappeared from the window. But now the crowd was enormous. Through all this, though all this had occurred in less than 7 minutes, the start of the fire and the thuds and the deaths, I heard screams around the corner and hurried there. What I had seen before was not so terrible as what had followed. Up in the ninth floor, girls were burning to death before our very eyes. They were jammed in the windows. No one was lucky enough to be able to jump, it seemed. But one by one, the jams broke. Down came the bodies in a shower, burning, smoking, flaming bodies with disheveled hair trailing upward. They had fought each other to die by jumping instead of by fire. The whole sound, unharmed girls. The whole sound, unharmed girls who had jumped on the other side of the building had tried to fall feet down. But these fire torches, suffering ones, fell inertly, only intent that death should come to them on the sidewalk instead of in the furnace behind them. On the sidewalk lay heaps of broken bodies. A policeman later went about with tags, which he fastened with wires to the wrists of the dead girls, numbering each with a lead pencil. And I saw him fasten tag number 54 to the wrist of a girl who wore an engagement ring. A fireman who came downstairs from the building told me that there were at least 50 bodies in the big room on the seventh floor. Another fireman told me that more girls had jumped down an air shaft in the rear of the building. I went back there, into the narrow court, and saw heaps of dead girls. The floods of water from the fireman's hose that ran into the gutter were actually stained red with blood. I looked upon the heap of dead bodies, and I remembered these girls were the shirtwaist makers. I remembered their great strike of last year, in which these same girls had demanded more sanitary conditions and more safety precautions in the shops. These dead bodies were the answer. After the tragedy, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union led a parade of more than 100,000 mourners through the streets of Lower Manhattan. And politicians realized that they'd better pay attention to what had just happened in their town. The cry, "This shall never happen again," echoed through city halls and state capitals. Officials in many major U.S. cities looked around and found identically dangerous conditions in their factories. Workers in their communities faced the same risk. Whether it was shame, guilt, or genuine concern for the safety of the American worker, politicians promised to do better. First in New York City and then in Albany, lawmakers, ignoring strident objections by the business community, forced through the country's first and strongest worker safety protection laws. Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Illinois soon passed similar safeguards. 15 other states tried to do the same, but intense lobbying by industry either blocked the attempts or watered down the legislation to the point of uselessness. But the fire also produced a champion for a national system of worker safety regulations. The afternoon of the fire, A young social worker named Frances Perkins was having tea with a friend in Greenwich Village when she heard clanging fire truck bells and screams. As she raced toward the noise, she saw the black smoke billowing from the building and watched as the seamstresses leaped or fell to the ground. 22 years later, President Franklin D. Roosevelt appointed Perkins as U.S. Secretary of Labor. Perkins never forgot the fire and the trapped workers, and she did much during her 12 years on the job, including creating what would become the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Worker safety advocates cite the painful irony that precisely 100 years to the month after that fire, the House of Representatives has passed a budget bill that would slash nearly $100 million from OSHA's current budget. About 40% of those cuts will be to the agency's enforcement and safety inspectors, those on the front line of protecting workers. More when we come back. Shirtwaist fire in Lower Manhattan 100 years ago today. It took the lives of 146, almost all of them women. The youngest was 11. The oldest, well, most of them were in their teens and 20s. They were mostly immigrants. Before the fire, they had demonstrated a year before in search of some safety rules, some protections for them. But the capitalists who owned the factory told them more or less to piss off. And as a result of all these deaths, some laws were passed. What I'm quoting to you from now is a piece that was at AOL today. Worker safety advocates cite the painful irony that precisely 100 years to the month after the fire that took 146 lives, the House of Representatives, under control of Republicans, has passed a budget bill that will slash nearly $100 million, about 20%, from OSHA's current budget. About 40% of those cuts will be to the agency's enforcement and safety inspectors, those on the front lines of protecting workers. Joel Shufro, executive director of the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, told AOL News yesterday, quote, "Lives will be lost because of these proposed cuts. They're devastating," end quote. He added, quote, "Since its founding, OSHA has been underfunded and understaffed. They currently have enough inspectors to inspect every workplace just once every 143 years. The proposed cuts will cut OSHA's effectiveness even more. OSHA Administrator David Michaels says the House's cutback, quote, would really have a devastating effect on all of our activities, end quote. And David Bondrail wrote what many considered the definitive book on the tragedy in 1911, the title Triangle, The Fire That Changed America. He said in the book that history can run backward and that even much-needed reforms like worker safety gains can be lost again. He wrote, quote, "Many of the initial post-Triangle reforms were strenuously opposed by conservative businessmen who were soon back in the saddle and able to halt hamstring or reverse liberal initiatives, end quote. Isn't that the way it always goes? These rotten son of a bitches who treat human life as an expendable product where it concerns their greed. When the Republicans swept back into power in the House in January, Representative Daryl Issa, the newly appointed chairman of the House Government Oversight and Government Affairs Committee, told major industries, lobbyists, trade associations, and companies large and small that as head of the Congressional Watchdog Committee, he'd appreciate their views on what government regulations they didn't like and what he should change. It surprised no one that the Environmental Protection Agency and OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, were the favorite targets of the hundreds of letters that were hand-carried or express mailed to him by the corporatists. Republican budget cutters say that environmental regulation is harmful to the economy and the OSHA's worker safety actions are unnecessary and detrimental to businesses large and small. Those involved with worker safety cringe. Tom O'Connor, executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, a federation of local and state committees or coalitions on occupational safety and health, said, quote, with conservatives in Congress decrying the supposedly job-killing effects of OSHA protections, we could be on our way to becoming a first-world economy with third-world working conditions, end quote. Passing laws, of course, isn't enough to save lives. On September 3rd, 1991, 20 years ago, 25 workers died from burns or suffocation, and another 54 were injured when a 25-foot-long deep-fat fryer burst into flames at the Imperial Foods Products chicken processing plant in Hamlet, North Carolina. As with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, the fire doors at this plant were locked to keep workers from stealing chickens. The plant had never been inspected, not by OSHA or any other federal or state safety agency, during its 11 years in operation. The deaths continue today. Look at what happened during 1 month last year. On April 2nd, an explosion at the Tesoro Petroleum Refinery in Anacortes, Washington, killed 7 workers. 3 days later, in West Virginia, 29 miners died when Massey Energy's Upper Big Branch mine exploded. 15 days later, on April 20, 40 miles off the Louisiana coast, the Deepwater Horizon offshore drilling unit exploded and killed 11 workers and injured 16 others. These multiple fatality tragedies garner headlines and cause politicians in Congress to bang their fists on the table demanding action. Said Tom O'Connor, the executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. He went on to say, quote, our country suffers from a silent epidemic of workplace deaths that elicit little or no outrage. He cited the construction worker with no harness who falls to his death from an unguarded roof, or the sanitation worker with no protection or training who enters a confined space permeated with deadly chemical fumes, or the 18-year-old kid in his first week on the job who's buried alive in a collapsed trench. The owners of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory were indicted by a grand jury on 7 counts, charged with manslaughter in the second degree under the U.S. Labor Code, which mandated that doors should not be locked during working hours. They avoided prison with the help of New York's finest, most prestigious, and highly paid lawyers, as well as a judge in their pocket, according to published reports. Michael Wright, director of Health, Safety, and Environment for the United Steelworkers, said, quote, OSHA badly needs an upgrade. The penalties are too low to be a deterrent to all but the smallest employers. The criminal provisions are insulting to workers. The maximum penalty for a willful violation that kills a worker is 6 months. Well, the penalties for environmental crimes, like harassing protected animal species, are 5 years or more. The National Park Service declared the site of the Triangle Shirtwaist Company a national landmark in 1991. The owners, Isaac Harris and Max Blanc, may have been acquitted of criminal charges, but their notoriety has long outlived them. Their insurance company paid $400 for each worker who died that day, about $60,000. According to documents collected by Cornell University, Harris and Blanc doled out just $75 to each family and pocketed the rest. The final note to this tragic epic is that the remains of six of the workers were so badly charred, their names were never known. But this year, a century later, Michael Hirsch, an historian and amateur genealogist, tracked down the identities of the missing six. For the first time, their names will be read with the other 140 who died that horrible day. And finally, this. From the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, just 3 months shy of the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Fire, back on December 14th, fire broke out at the Hamim factory in Bangladesh, which was sewing garments for the Gap. The fire alarms did not go off, and the emergency exits were locked on the ninth floor, killing 29 workers, many of whom jumped to their deaths and injuring over 100. At Hamim, the workers toil 12 to 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, with just a single day off a month. The highest wage at that factory is 28 cents an hour, less than one-tenth of what the Triangle workers earned 100 years ago. Adjusted for inflation, the 14 cents an hour they earned in 1911 is worth $3.18 an hour today. The garment workers in Bangladesh are trapped in misery, living in makeshift hovels. Just months before the tragic fire, Triangle workers had led a strike to organize garment workers in New York City and ultimately had been beaten back by their own factory's management. In Hamim, too, management busted a union organizing drive in September 2008, imprisoning the union president and firing all 19 of the lead activists. It did not matter that well over half of the workers supported the union's demands. We are at a crossroads. We can stand back and allow corporations to drive this race to the bottom, exploiting sweatshop workers across the developing world, or we can fight back and hold corporations accountable to respect local labor and minimum wage laws. The choice is ours.
Listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malone.
This hour is sponsored by Russ C. in Hollywood, Florida. His message, retired 1 week ago after 32 years as a professional firefighter and proud union member of the IAFF Local 1375. Solidarity now and solidarity forever from Russ C. in Hollywood. And again, it was Alice at Helen Hollers in Arkansas who requested that we cover, and she sent me the story, The Eyewitness at the Triangle, that was written all those years ago, 100 years ago. Thanks to both of you, Alice and Russ. From Prairie 2, on the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, We stand poised to see the end of every advance to have come from that tragedy. Strong unions came from the deaths of those 146 workers that day. The U.S. Department of Labor came 2 years later. Child labor laws became the norm as the majority of those killed were teenage girls. The International Ladies Garment Union that came to prominence after the fire has ceased to exist as the production has all but been outsourced. In Bangladesh alone, there have been 414 garment workers killed in factory fires in recent years. Almost all were young girls. Republicans chant that we must do away with all the burdensome regulations that send our jobs overseas. Child labor laws, government inspectors, labor unions, all regulations of business soon to become a thing of history. Of course, there won't be any history, as the first thing Republicans do when coming to office is flush history down the memory hole. The removal of artwork from the Labor Department in Maine, the rewriting of school books to the absolute control of news media, the assault on knowledge by Republicans is unrelenting. Not that Republicans don't create jobs. Besides making blouses in Bangladesh, that's what a shirt waist is, they have been creating them in the United States. Now, for every three conventional workers in the U.S., there is one protecting the wealth of the top 1%. This includes police, prison guards, and private security, from the mall cop to the armed response team protecting the gated community. We aren't quite the police state of East Germany. They employed 40% of their workers guarding the rest, but it is a growth industry here. Increasingly, it's not the security state, but it is private industry. Republicans can't privatize the prisons fast enough. Police are one of the first things they cut from the budget, and the new austerity requires that they don't spend much time protecting the common citizen. Security is something you have only if you can pay for it. Feeling insecure? Don't worry. The Alaska bill is making the rounds in the state legislatures. The Alaska bill? Well, it might be called the Arizona bill, except for that unpleasantness involving a member of Congress outside a strip mall there not long ago. It's also called the constitutional carry law for handguns, or really, no law for handguns. A Republican was inadvertently recorded on the floor of the Iowa House explaining it to a colleague. It's the give a gun to a schizophrenic law. Well, at least we don't live in Japan. The government there has admitted that there must be some leakage from the number three reactor that has the plutonium fuel, and they have expanded the evacuation zone. Now they are trying to walk back that information, saying the workers may have been burned from some other source. This is the 99th anniversary of the mayor of Tokyo giving the cherry trees to Washington, D.C. The world has changed so much, but yet it really hasn't. PrairieNumeral2.com. We will be joined by Sam Cedar after the break at the top of the hour. And also tonight, twice, count them twice, we are going to give away podcast subscriptions free on Podcast Trivia. And these are courtesy of Sean, who donated 12 of these podcasts with a call to all engineers and scientists to join him in boycotting corporations. He wrote, "Engineers, scientists, and all experts in the technical trades, please join me in boycotting your hard work and intellectual efforts to big corporations who are destroying the country. Pledge to stop giving your good ideas and solutions to big corporations and focus on those organizations who work to better our lives instead of destroying them. I need your help to make this work. Thank you, Sean." And we thank you, Sean. So once again, Russ C. in Hollywood, California, who sponsored the first hour. His message: retired 1 week ago after 32 years as a professional firefighter and proud union member of IAFF Local 1375. Solidarity now and solidarity forever. And also, once again, it was Alice down at Helen Howler's who suggested this first hour. She had a message, too. In memory of the 146 workers, most of them women, who died 100 years ago today in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And as Mother Jones, the woman, not the magazine, said, mourn for the dead, fight for the living. And you can find out all you want to know about what Alice has got to offer from Heel and Hollers by going to MikeMalloy.com, and you'll find her ad there. Just click on it and get yourself some of that summer good smelling repellent. All right. I hope the history didn't bum you out, but how do we know where we're going unless we can consider where we've been, right? Stick around. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour. It's the Malloy Show, and this hour sponsored by Rick Fassholtz. No message, just Rick sponsoring it. Thanks, Rick. Oh my goodness, look who's here. It's Sam Cedar calling from the Big Apple. Hey, Sam.
How are you, Mike?
I'm fair to partly cloudy. How about you?
Hanging in there.
That's good. What is this slide into Saturday with Sam Cedar?
That's what I'm calling.
Oh, that's what Kathy calls this segment.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that.
I wasn't either. Slide into Saturday. It's good alliteration. I mean, you can't deny that, but...
I figure if you can say it, you must be sober.
There you go. All right.
Right. There you go.
All right, Sam.
Sulk into Saturday, maybe.
Sulk into Saturday. How was Wisconsin? I see you made it back okay.
Yeah, it was fantastic. You know, I'm still sort of like basking in the glow. Although I'll tell you this, I don't know if you're aware of this, but just about a couple hours ago, I'm sure you've talked about how the anti-union bill that Scott Walker had signed a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Actually, the Secretary of State was enjoined by a court in Wisconsin from publishing the bill because there were questions as to the way that the bill was passed. Specifically, at one point when they stripped out the part of the bill that had to do with all the budgetary issues, they
right.
just left the collective bargaining attacks in there. They didn't follow the 24-hour open meeting law in Wisconsin. So a court enjoined the Secretary of State from signing from publishing the bill, but somehow the Republicans had somebody else publish the bill. I mean, I honestly, this sounds ridiculous, but they had somebody else publish the bill. I don't know if it was done on Facebook or what.
Would it be a privatized Secretary of State?
No kidding. I'm not quite sure what they did. Nobody seems to be quite aware. The Legislative Reference Bureau published the bill, and the Republicans are saying now it's law. I mean, it's stunning. It's stunning, and you know, I'm not convinced that they're not doing this type of thing to try and push it to the state Supreme Court before the election on April 4th, when the Republican who's running for re-election, because they elect their state Supreme Court justices,
right.
I think is looking like he might lose. And I think they're rushing it. They're trying to figure out any way they can to rush it to the state Supreme Court before that election.
Well, what's the implied or the implication then, that the Supreme Court is politicized? Oh, my goodness.
Well, yeah, in Wisconsin, it's literally politicized. I mean, they run for it. This guy, I think his name is Prosser, had already said, like, look, I'm gonna rubber stamp whatever Scott Walker does. I mean, I think he almost literally said that.
Well, that's nice that a judge, for Christ's sake, who is supposed to rule on state constitutional issues, would say that. Isn't that wonderful, Sam? I mean, it's just stunning to me how far Republicans go. It doesn't make any difference what branch of government they're in,
right.
How far they'll go. It's astonishing.
Well, I mean, I think we found that out in 2000, didn't we? I mean,
I think we did.
Are not even elected, and I think the veneer of judicial impartiality and judicial temperament, as it were, was sort of thrown out the window as far as I was concerned in 2000.
Did you, I don't know if you heard this or not, the latest. Hold on a minute. Let me reach down here on the floor because I mentioned it this morning. And then, I mentioned it at the beginning of the program and then I dropped it here on the floor. The latest from the Obama administration, if you remember a guy, a psychologist who was hired by, I think, the Department of Defense or the Department of Justice, I forget which one, a psychologist hired to work out the torture techniques at both Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. His name is Dr. Larry James. He's a retired Army colonel. He was the chief psychologist at Guantanamo in 2003 at the height of the torture abuses and then served in the same position, Abu Ghraib, in 2004. Well, today, this guy circulated an email that said the following, quote, with great pride, I have been selected to serve on the White House Task Force entitled Enhancing the Psychological Well-Being of the Military Family. Now, in this new position, Sam, he'll be meeting at the White House with Michelle Obama and other White House officials on Tuesday. I mean, what the hell is going on? This is a guy who brought the entire field of psychology and just about nailed it to a tree. Doctors, psychologists, and I realize, psychologists are not MDs, but they hold positions of power. And, you know, what's the rule? First, do no harm. And this bastard was instrumental in deciding the best torture techniques to use. And now Obama has appointed him to a White House task force. I don't know where you stand on the Obama thing, my friend, but I am so over this man. I just can't tell you. I mean, this is like the last nail in the last coffin.
The most sort of appalling aspect of the Obama administration has been the things that were supposed to be the best in terms of, I mean, here's a guy who was a constitutional law professor and had talked about FISA before, mm-hmm. before the election, I can understand, you know, people would write off the notion that he wasn't going to, in any way pursue the Bush administration's torture policy, or bring any accountability, but this is a guy whose administration went far beyond than just sort of, the misfeasance involved in not bringing these people to justice. He actually quashed attempts by the Spanish and the German government
mm-hmm.
from bringing these people to justice. It's appalling. And, you know, the Bradley Manning thing is also one more element that is appalling. I mean, I can understand he had enormous difficulty in closing Guantanamo because there was, frankly, the Democratic, lawmakers in the House and the Senate were incredibly weak-kneed and sort of cut it out from under him. But this type of stuff is just—it's shocking and appalling. And you know, I can understand his. Well, I mean, I understand is the wrong word, but I'm not completely blown over by the guy's inability to actually pursue to fight on behalf of working people and fight on behalf of certain policies. But his complete and utter disregard for the constitutional processes, and that one would have thought that even in his most timid, even in his most ineffectual, MO, he would have pursued. And so this is the most disappointing aspect of the Obama administration to me, although there are other disappointing aspects of the Obama administration to me as well. But this is really, it's stunning. I mean, you know, and we may disagree on this to a certain extent, but I am not completely opposed to what we're doing in Libya, to this war, at least in terms of its very limited mandate from the UN. But what stuns me about this guy is, how do you not go to Congress first? I mean, you know, we have an opportunity. We've just come out of 10 years. We are waging two wars. And as far as I'm concerned, Iraq was completely illegal by just about every possible standards whatsoever. Afghanistan is a complete joke, our involvement there, except for the people who are on the receiving end of our bombs. But at the very least, the one thing that you can say about this Libya intervention is at least it is sanctioned internationally. I know it's because ultimately it's sanctioned internationally because people have a vested interest in terms of oil in that country.
Right.
And would never do the same for the Ivory Coast or Bahrain.
Or any place else in Africa. Hey, Sam, hold on. Let me do a break. Hold on. We'll be right back. We're talking with Sam Cedar from Ring of Fire. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy.
Yet tonight, how much he hates these people. It's more Mike Molloy.
Yeah, it is. 21 past the hour. This hour is sponsored by Rick Fasholtz. Thanks, Rick. We're talking with Sam Cedar, who has joined us from New York City. He is the co-host of Ring of Fire that you can hear tomorrow. You know, regarding Libya, Sam, I think we will disagree on this. I understand the apparent humanitarian aspect of it, in the same way that Clinton ordered General Wesley Clark to go after the Serbs in Middle Europe during his administration. But let me quote for you what Obama said when he was a candidate. The president does not have power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not involve stopping an actual or imminent threat to the nation. And that was constitutionally sound, what he said. So the problem here, if Barack Obama sincerely saw that a humanitarian effort was needed using bombs and bullets and so on and so forth to stop Gaddafi, he had a very clear path that he could follow. Now, having said that, I understand, and so do you, and I think so do most people who can still think in this country, that no matter what Obama did, these filthy Republicans would have attacked him. So there is that issue, but still, for Obama to do this, and using the cover of the UN, I don't think is the appropriate cover at all. What now we're in a situation with this Libya adventure where I mean, this is like a Three Stooges, a short film from the 30s. Nobody knows. I mean, who's in charge? Who's supposed to do what? Where does this go? Where do we put tab A and slot B? What's over here? What's flying? What's not flying? You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with you completely about Obama not following, A, what I think is constitutionally mandated, and B, what he perceived in 2007 as being constitutionally mandated. And I think obviously that's problematic. And I agree that, you know, had he taken it to Congress like he should have, or at the very least, you know, gotten some type of authorization from them, it would have been, we would have seen the Republicans do all sorts of shenanigans. But I think ultimately, it would have actually been authorized. And, the difference between, let me tell you why I support this at least to the extent that, I think actually on some level, that morally, I think this is on some level justifiable. I don't know that it's constitutional if he doesn't go to the Congress. But be that as it may, as opposed to Iraq, this was sanctioned by the UN. It was petitioned by the Arab League. Now, and before I even say this, let me preface it with saying that we're not doing this with the Ivory Coast. We're not doing it anywhere else in the world. If Libya didn't have oil, we would not be doing this. The Europeans wouldn't care, the Italians wouldn't care, the Brits wouldn't care if BP didn't want to get better contracts there. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that those people in Benghazi, I think there's very good reason to believe that they would have been slaughtered. I mean, in a massive massacre. And to the extent that I can even know these things, I actually think the UN, despite all the flaws that's involved and despite the intent and motives of the players who go there, are certainly not less than pure and may not be humanitarian at all, mm-hmm. in the final analysis. But it will have a humanitarian effect, and I think there's probably no better institution in which to sanction something like this. Because, you know, as opposed to Iraq, which was a completely internationally illegal war, and I think, frankly, illegal in the context of this country because we were lied to as an American public, this at least has some body that is standing in the way of a unilateral action by the American. And frankly, I am more willing to trust the UN's determination in terms of war or kinetic military engagement, whatever they want to call it, so that we don't realize we're at war, than I do our government at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we have tremendous influence at the UN, but I don't think we could have gotten China and Russia and Turkey to abstain in these situations if there wasn't a compelling aspect of this to people around the world. And now, you know, if we stop where we said we would stop, that being we do not take offensive actions on a military unless they are attacking civilians. If we stop at this point, which I think, you know, there's every reason to be suspicious of the fact that we would stop.
Mm-hmm.
But if we stop and do not pursue the American policy of regime change in a military fashion, then I actually think this is the way it should work.
But
the aspect of Obama going to Congress.
I'm gonna put you on hold again because we got a break here, Sam. Can you stick around a little bit?
Yeah,
please. Okay, let me put you on hold. But a question when we come back, given that Obama's stated goal, regardless of what the UN said, regardless of what the French or the British have said, Obama's goal is the removal of Gaddafi. That is regime change. And to find a justifiable part of it, like Saddam gassing the Kurds, is a little dodgy for me. It still is. Sam, hold on. We'll be right back. Stay with us, Truth Seekers. I'm Mike Malloy.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom.
to listen to Right Wing Radio. Here's Mike Malone.
26 before the hour. And this hour is sponsored by Rick Fosholtz. Thanks, Rick. We're talking with Sam Cedar, co-host of Ring of Fire and frequent contributor to MSNBC. We're talking about a couple of things here. Before we go on, Sam, a couple of emails here. First one is from Kate in the desert regarding the attack on Libya. She says, well, I can't say what she really says, but the initials are BS. She writes, no matter what the reason, we have no logical business being in the Middle East. There is something else behind this, and it won't be over for a long time. Why does it have such a dramatic name? Who writes these scripts? Odyssey. Any long journey filled with adventure and hardships. Dawn. The beginning. You know, it's called Odyssey Dawn. This is more about Kissinger and Negroponte and all those boys who need disruption and control. I am working with homeless and crippled vets here in Montana. Many of them who talk to me are tired of this, even the young ones. It is truly heartbreaking to see the mess that we have made of our youngsters. A couple of trips through the outpatient clinic at the VA hospital should give sane folks a clue. Kate, you know, that's kind of the overarching attitude that I have too, Sam, that I've just had enough of this. I really have. Now, let me move on. Paul in Martinez, California, wants to ask you something, and he sent an email. Could you ask Sam about the election of the Supreme Court Justice in Wisconsin? I know you mentioned it, but he says, I would hope that the energy that has gone into the demonstrations in Madison would go into helping elect a Democrat to the Supreme Court. You did mention it, but just for Paul's sake, what is your take on what's going on there in terms of this contest?
Well, you know, as far as I know, there's no polling. I mean, because this is, you know, people are not used to polling Supreme Court elections. But, you know, there was a debate the other night, and it turns out the Republican has a history of throwing huge temper tantrums and calling his fellow justices, you know, the word that you would use for a dog that doesn't have a mother, or I guess father. I'm not sure what, but...
You mean bitch?
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I do my daily podcast, and yeah, I can say a lot worse than that. So I gotta keep myself measured.
I hear you.
But yeah. So you know, I think there's a real concern on the part of the Republicans because I mean I got news for you. After leaving Madison, it was hard for me to imagine that a Republican is going to be elected to any statewide office in that state for generations. Now, of course, I thought that about this country just about 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? But there were so many kids out there. I mean, I was walking down the street in Madison going to have a beer at the end of the night one night. It was Saturday night. And there were a bunch of, you know, drunk college kids walking down the street like you would see in any type of college town. Except for they were chanting, hey, hey, ho, ho, Scott Walker's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that you normally see.
Right.
You know, the kids who are that engaged in what's going on. And so it was very heartening in that respect. And I think, you know, if I had to place a bet from afar, I would say that there's a good chance the Democrats going to win. And, you know, when we say Democrat in Wisconsin, we're talking about these state Democrats. They're behaving a lot differently than the national ones.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I think in some instances they're very rare and they're few and far between. But there are Democrats and especially in a state like Wisconsin that gave birth to the progressive movement. You still find Democrats who are Democrats. It's just that they have to, as we say in the South, they have to get shed of that label. Because the Democratic Party, I think for so many people across the country, and I'm not talking about the crazy right wingers, I'm talking about Democrats who have tried again and again and again to elect members of Congress who will take that progressive or that liberal attitude. And the word Democrat applied with a capital D, I think a lot of people are getting leery of it. So when there are candidates, when there are politicians or incipient politicians or wannabe politicians, I should say, who really believe in those original organizing principles and the coalition building principles and the progressive principles of the Democratic Party, they better get a different name because Democrat – has gotten fairly or unfairly, and I think it's fairly because so many Democrats, you and I talked about this the other day, so many Democrats have completely given up the ghost and are just there. They're get along, go along. They are, so many of them are paid for by the same people that, bring us the Republicans. So, you know, it's kind of a mess. Let me move to something else here. I want to get your take on the situation in Japan. Kathy and I were talking today that this situation is getting so bad and so critical, and I mean in a sense of physics, critical mass, and so on and so forth. It appears that a certain not small part of Japan is going to be uninhabitable for centuries.
Yeah,
I mean. Go ahead.
I do the Majority Report every morning, mm-hmm. and one of my listeners has contacted me the other day, and he's a school teacher, an American who's over there with his family teaching school, and he's actually headed up north to take a look at it to check out what's going on in that area, because you know what happened at the Fukushima plant is not near the worst part of the earthquake and the tsunami damage and destruction.
Right.
It's pretty unimaginable what they must be going through over there with, you know, sort of recovering from this massive man-made disaster and then dealing with this sort of sword of Damocles hanging over their head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, according to this guy, the reports of water being having radiation problems in Tokyo
mm-hmm.
is maybe, you know, to him not as alarming as it would be because there's such strict standards in Japan. But with that said, my understanding is that there's a tremendous anger towards TEPCO,
mm-hmm.
this company and the government, and particularly the former government that sort of gave a blessing to all of these power plants, because TEPCO on many occasions was caught
cheating, lying. Sure.
Was caught with, there was an engineer who came out apparently a couple years ago, particularly after Chernobyl, when he was hired at the time, it was his job to fix the computer modeling which showed that there were structural problems with a TEPCO nuclear power plant. He got a $35,000 bonus. He was very proud of himself until after Chernobyl. He tried to go to the government. They didn't listen to him. He tried to go to other places. They didn't listen to him. I don't think what's happening is necessarily a function of this, but there's no reason to believe that TEPCO was any more honest about anything else they did.
That's not just indicative of nuclear energy people in Japan. We get the same lies here.
Well, that's exactly the point.
Right.
That's exactly the point. It's like, you know, say what you will. I hear people can make arguments that in a hypothetical or a theoretical way that nuclear power can be safe. I believe that it's theoretically possible. But the problem is, we can't even trust our government to make sure that, these deep water drills stop exploration when we haven't even figured out why the last one destroyed the Gulf. I mean, mm-hmm. we're not going to get a second chance if Indian Point goes, you know.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. I mean, that's going to wipe out. I don't want to talk apocalyptic stuff like the movie The Road. But if Indian Point goes, you can't even think about it. But, you know, as far as nuclear power, Sam, it may be possible in theory, as you say, to make nuclear reactors and the generation of power using those reactors safe. But it raises the immediate question. What do you do with the byproduct, plutonium?
Right.
That cannot be made safe. It is the most toxic substance that there is. And that is the byproduct. You know, when you burn coal, the byproduct is a destroyed atmosphere. When you burn, uranium, the byproduct is a substance whose half-life is 250,000 years. So, based on that, I can't go for nuclear energy. There was a time And recently, I'm not talking about when I was a kid, when we were told it was going to be so cheap it'd be free, but I'm talking about recently, after working in the anti-nuke movement in the 80s, about a decade ago, I started thinking, well, maybe there is a way to do this as an alternative to fossil fuels. But I've come back to the original premise that I had, the original understanding that I had, because I went to Savannah River Nuclear Plant where it was stored when it was owned by DuPont, and saw learned what plutonium is all about. I had no idea. I never heard of plutonium until the 80s, or, well, till the late 70s. I didn't know what the hell it was. But once you find out what it is, and you realize that no matter how you do these nuclear reactors, that is the byproduct, then all of a sudden the theoretical safety starts to disappear. Sam, let me put you on hold again. Sure. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and wrap it up. We're talking with Sam Seder of MSNBC and the host of Ring of Fire and his own majority report. And damn it, hold on a minute. Sam, what's your majority report web address, quick?
Majority.fm.
.fm, that's right. Majority.fm. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Rick Fasholtz. Thanks, Rick. We've been talking with Sam Seder, Majority.fm online, frequent guest host on MSNBC, and the co-host of Ring of Fire. What do you got left?
just a lot of regrets.
a lot of regrets.
it's a tough time. I mean, you know, I'm still sort of like coming out of this sort of just incredible disappointment over Obama and frankly, the Democratic Party, and still trying to figure out, what the best way forward is. I mean, what's best we can hope for, and, to a large extent, we're back to playing defense again on some level, whether it's, protecting things like Social Security, which I'm, very concerned that, in the backdrop of all these catastrophes and wars, and that there is, the plutocrats are gathering in Washington right now to decide that we have to finally, with a stroke of a pen, basically perpetrate the greatest theft from the middle class, perhaps in the history of this country, and I'm talking specifically about Social Security. It's coming down the pike. I mean, you could start to see the outlines of this thing. There was a story today that, and you remember this, back in 2004, Bush had passed the so-called American Jobs Creation Act. And what it was one of those, beautifully named pieces of legislation, which basically said to international companies that were based in the United States, hey, you know that 35% of taxes that you usually have to pay when you repatriate those profits? We'll let you bring it in for 5% if you, vaguely promise to create jobs. And, of course, billions and billions of dollars came back to the United States, and it created no jobs. In fact, many of those companies cut jobs,
right,
and all they did was give dividends to their shareholders. And this idea is being floated again, And today, Geithner basically came out and said, well, you know, and I guess we should be thankful that at least they're not giving it away. He came out and said, well, you know, we'd consider it if it's part of a broader package, which presumably is going to include cuts to Social Security, which, you know, so at the end of the day, they're basically saying, we will give into corporate interest if we also have the opportunity to steal money for just the rich.
Well, you know, also today, I think it was today, in the Times, General Electric, which is this nation's largest corporation, as was put by the Times, had a very good year in 2010. The company reported worldwide profits of $14.2 billion, and $5.1 billion of that total came from the operation in the United States. And the tax bill? Zero. In fact, General Electric claimed a tax benefit of $3.2 billion. Now, this can be repeated with corporation after corporation. And I swear to God, as long as we have a situation like this, loopholes, where the largest corporation in America can show a profit of $14.2 billion and not pay and $5.1 billion of it comes from its operations in the United States, and not pay a penny. Sam, you paid more income tax when you filed your return here, so did I, than General Electric did. Now,
well, Mike, to be fair, they bring good things to life, design of the Fukushima plant.
Yeah, they certainly did a good job there, didn't they? Oh, my God. But this is the problem. This is the problem. Yes. I agree that the assault, the greed heads who want to get their fingers into Social Security, you're absolutely right. But it's like the uber wealthy, they don't want 99% of everything. They want 100%. And the fact that the former head of General Electric, Jeffrey Immelt, is now Obama's top advisor, another example of Barack Obama being exactly opposite of what a lot of people thought he was. So
yes,
here we are.
Without a doubt. And, you know, to know that if people making over $1 million today paid the same share, the same effective tax rate, not actual stated, but the same share of their income in taxes as they did in 1961, we would have $382 billion more a year.
Wow.
$382 billion if they paid the same effective tax rates as 1961.
Mm-hmm.
We are at the lowest point in tax revenues relative to GDP in 60 years.
Oh, we are. I know. That's why every time I hear these teabag bastards talk about we're overtaxed and they're sick of paying taxes, and then if they would just shut up and realize that the effective tax rate is about 15% right now, and that when you consider all taxes, I don't care what they are, all taxes, the U.S. public right now is least taxed than it's ever been, except maybe for the time when there was no such thing as an income tax. But
you've got to go back to 1913.
There you go.
And I've actually been in conversations where conservatives have lamented that we're not like we were in 1913,
right.
Which, of course, you know, there were 100 people a day dying. I think, you know, you talked about the shirtwaist triangle fire factory.
Right.
There were 100 people dying a day on their jobs at that time.
I hear you. Hey, Sam. Hear that music?
I do.
It's time to go. Hey, listen, thanks a lot. Ring of Fire, what time tomorrow?
Well, it depends on where you are, but generally 3 p.m. Eastern.
3 p.m. Eastern. All right. Sam Cedar, Majority.fm, MSNBC, and co-host of Ring of Fire. Sam, we'll see you next Friday. Take care, okay?
Always a pleasure, Mike. Thanks.
All right, sir. We'll talk to you later. Sam Cedar, check him out. We'll be back after the break. We're going to be giving away two free podcast subscriptions coming up. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome. That's easy for you to say. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. All right. I'm looking for a couple of people here who want to win a free 1-year podcast subscription to this program. Downloads, a whole bunches of them. Retail value of $59.40, I think. It'll give you a fresh Malloy program in your email every day that you can then download to any device you want to. So the number here is 877-996-2556. All you have to do is get the right answer, and you win. Sponsorship for this hour from Bruce in Los Angeles, known as Oompa underscore Wonkaville. On eBay. Okay. His message, Mike, you need to stay on the air. I will just simply die. Thank you. Keep it lit. Well, all right, Bruce. We will definitely, that's the goal, to stay on the air. But Bruce from L.A. Is our sponsor this hour. Also known as Oompa underscore Wonkaville on eBay. And his message, Mike, you need to stay on the air, I would just simply die. Wow. I don't want that to happen. And neither does anybody else. So we will absolutely do it. The General Electric thing that we were talking about right before the break, it was in the Times today, and it's GE's strategies. Let it avoid taxes altogether. Now, I didn't want to put Sam on the spot because Sam co-hosts a lot, or not co-hosts, but he substitute hosts a lot on MSNBC, which is now partly owned by General Electric. But it's astonishing to me that we have corporations like this, and this is the nation's largest, GE, whose former president now works for our soon-to-be former president, Jeffrey Immelt. And they just, where is the reasonableness that you have a corporation that makes $14.2 billion in profit worldwide, $5.1 billion from its operations in the United States, and Bob Kincaid at the Head-On Radio Network paid more in taxes last year than General Electric did? Huh? Where's the sense in that? In a regulatory filing just a week before the Japanese disaster put a spotlight on GE's nuclear reactor business, GE reported that its tax burden was 7.4% of its American profits, which is about a third of the average reported by other American multinationals. And even those figures are overstated because they include taxes that would be paid only if the company brings its overseas profits back to the U.S. And as the Times says, such strategies, as well as changes in tax laws that encouraged some businesses and professionals to file as individuals, those strategies have pushed down the corporate share of the nation's tax receipts from about 30% of all federal revenue in the mid-50s to 6.6% in 2009. And yet, how many of these companies go out and hire these brain-dead sons of bitches, these teabaggers, to whine and bitch and carry signs about being taxed? And then they say that the current level, 6.6%, is so high it hobbles them in competing with foreign rivals. Now, if you want to know essentially why the company or the country is bankrupt, that's the reason. There is no doubt. There's no debate. That's the reason. But Obama said he is considering an overhaul of the corporate tax system with an eye to lowering the top corporate rate. He wants to lower it even further. And ending some tax subsidies and loopholes. Yeah, they always throw that in there, right? He has designated GE's chief executive. I guess he's still the chief executive, Jeffrey Immelt, as Obama's liaison to the business community. And Jeffrey Immelt is the chairman of the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. All right, can I see a show of hands out there? How many people are going to vote for Barack Obama again? Huh? Anybody? Oh, yeah, a lot of hands going up. What the hell is wrong with you? He hires onto his council on how to help American service personnel. He hires the psychologist and the Army officer who helped devise the torture techniques at both Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. And then he hires Jeffrey Immelt, whose company figured out a way to avoid paying any taxes. And there's still people out there that think Obama is worthy of being president, is worthy of being a leader. Barack Obama has turned out to be what a lot of people thought he was. I didn't think he would be this bad. But a lot of people emailed me before the election and said, you know, you shouldn't even support him, Mike, by default. And I didn't listen. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I couldn't believe it. So here we are. Jeffrey Immelt, the president or the CEO of the largest corporation in the nation, whose profits of $5.1 billion came from its operations in the United States. The other $9 billion came from overseas operations. And not only has he not paid a penny in taxes in 2010, it claimed a tax benefit of $3.2 billion. Don't you wish you could hire that kind of a accounting firm to do for you? No, you wouldn't, because you're patriotic. You believe in paying your fair share, right? Son of a bitches, I'll tell you. All right. Do we have time? No, we don't have time to do it right now, but we will. As soon as we come back from this break, I see we have a couple of people who want to play podcast trivia. From Michael in Roswell, New Mexico, regarding the report about the Triangle Shirtwaist fire and how the insurance company paid, what was it, $400 per dead employee, and the owners of Triangle Shirtwaist kept everything except $75 that they gave to the families of the victims. So typically corporatist even back then. Anyway, Michael writes, how does pocketing the insurance money from workers dead from the fire differ from the so-called dead peasant insurance of today? Yeah. The same greedy impulses that work 100 years ago are present today. When capitalism's apologists say that it has given us the best standard of living in the world, they're lying. What has given us what we have are the social and workplace protections for which workers had to fight and fight hard. And it looks from the work of this latest crop of corrupt politicians that those battles will have to be fought over and over again. When the likes of Kasich and Snyder and Walker and Boehner talk about freedom, it's not freedom as you and I understand it. It's actually a code word indicating that they're happy with the idea of returning the country to the Gilded Age, a time when workers were disposable, wretched excess on the part of the wealthy was the norm, politicians had their hands out, and the United States was a third world country. We could end up there again. Michael in Roswell. We'll be right back. is time once again for podcast trivia, where you can win a one-year subscription to Malloy Program Downloads. Well, where did you put the podcast trivia? Oh, here it is. All right. All you have to do is get the right answer. If you get the right answer, you win. Lauren is in Chicago. Hey, Lauren.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I just want to say, for somebody who's been listening to you for like 7 years, we really miss the voice of Marge out here.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear. All right. Are you ready to play this game?
Yeah, we doing Bushisms?
No, we're going to do some current events. So listen up.
Fair enough.
You get a chance to win a one-year subscription. Here we go. The governor of what state in the Midwest signed legislation that gives him legal authority, not terribly unlike the legal authority granted Adolf Hitler, to replace elected legislative bodies in cities and counties with an overseer who can then dictate policies?
Michigan.
What? wait a minute! Was it A, Wisconsin, B, Michigan, C, Indiana, D, Ohio?
I'm going with RoboCop in Michigan.
Yeah, well, you win. All right. Ah, you guys are too quick on the draw. There's so much bad stuff going on in the other states that... I thought that might be a little bit of a tricky question, but I guess not. Lauren, congratulations, okay? Lauren?
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Okay, hold on. Kathy will take care of the business of... And stay right there, because we're going to do the second one right now. Robin is in Minnesota. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine. Are you ready to do this?
Yeah, I guess so. I've tried a million times.
Okay, let's see if you can get it this time. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Five Republican teabaggers in the U.S. House this week introduced a bill that had hidden inside it a provision that said any household that had a family member who engaged in a labor strike would A, be deported, B, have to give the family's firstborn to Dick Cheney to be used when Cheney needs spare body parts, C, lose eligibility for food stamps, or D, be forced to stand naked in front of the White House before having breakfast?
C.
Lose eligibility for food stamps. You're absolutely right. All right, Robin. You finally got it, right?
Yeah, I finally got through, and I finally got it.
All right, hold on. I'm going to put you on hold along with Lauren, and Kathy is going to pick up and take the proper information from both Lauren and Robin, so don't either one of you hang up. And again, thanks to one of our listeners named Sean, who donated 12 podcasts for giveaway on the program. Sean, we thank you very, very much. And so the people who win these, I think, I hope they do. And I did mention this hour is sponsored by Bruce in L.A., also known as Oompa_Wonkaville on eBay. Mike, you need to stay on the air. I will simply die. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Bruce. Cat Mary in Memphis. Regarding Jeffrey Immelt working for Obama now and the psychologist who devised torture techniques working for Obama now, Kat Mary writes, let's not forget Obama's Monsanto shills either. Tom Vilsack, who now works for the Department of Agriculture, Michael Taylor, Food and Drug Administration, Rajiv Shah, U.S. Agency for International Development, and Islam Siddiqui, U.S. Trade Representative and Chief Agricultural Negotiator. And, Kat Mary writes, there are others, just like radioactive cockroaches. These are all people who worked for Monsanto at one time. Kat Mary, is that right? And she also writes, we have a friend, Kat Mary writes, who worked on the Riverbend nuke plant in Louisiana. Each and every weld in that plant was supposed to be x-rayed twice along the entire weld to check for safety. Our friend says that didn't happen. Some welds were x-rayed others weren't. The company had to look good by meeting deadlines, so they falsified the records, and so-called regulators signed off on them. Riverbend Unit Number 1 was declared one of the top 10 worst in the United States. Our friend says he won't even drive by that plant, much less live near it. Deregulation kills people. Captain Marion, Memphis. Hi. All right, we have a break here. Then we'll come back and see what other kind of horror and terrors we can dredge up for your Friday night enjoyment. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It's Friday night. It's not Saturday night. It's Friday night.
He watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's More Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, it appears the government of Syria now is opening fire and butchering their people. I wonder if we're going to invade there. Wait a minute, does Syria have any oil? Oh, Malloy, you're such a cynic. And the efforts of the People's Rebellion in Egypt, it looks like it is coming a cropper, as they say. Egypt is now showing warning signs. Fawad Ajami is on CNN with the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies that the military is about to crack down in Egypt. Gee, there's a surprise. I got this from Kay Petrini, our education affairs correspondent. And I want to share this with you before we go to your calls. Mike, just a few thoughts on a foggy Friday evening here in San Francisco. Where are the real leaders? I guess it's normal to ask this question after having finished a unit on FDR. She teaches high school. But this time, teaching about FDR's incredible leadership of this country through the Depression and World War II is different. When I covered this material last year and the year before, I was under the impression that the United States had turned a corner. I believed that we had elected the first real leader since FDR, or at the very least since JFK. It's now absolutely clear that President Obama is no FDR, nor is he JFK, and he never will be. Quote, how is it possible that the things FDR proposed in 1945 are further out of reach than ever before, end quote. Anyone who has seen Michael Moore's film Capitalism, A Love Story has seen the footage of FDR outlining his proposal for a second Bill of Rights in his final State of the Union address. I showed this clip to my students today and then asked them to assess which of these rights have been realized. Most of them just shook their heads and said, none of them. To which I added, if you've been paying attention to current events in places like Wisconsin and Michigan, you know that some parts of the country have moved back to pre-FDR and even pre-progressive policies. I left it at that, although believe me, I wanted to say much more. From FDR's second Bill of Rights speech. We have come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these in the Bill of Rights are the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. End of FDR's Second Bill of Rights speech. And Kay adds, in our day, the economic truths that FDR championed have been replaced with the economic philosophies of the Gilded Age. To think of how the right-wing bastards have demonized Roosevelt and have almost completely succeeded in undoing his legacy makes me so angry I can't breathe. Okay. Phone calls. Chris is in Albuquerque. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Mike.
How are you?
I called actually, it's kind of off topic. What I wanted to say was about the unemployment thing. And this information doesn't come from, you know, the back of a matchbook. Apparently, the FICA taxes stop at $106,000 and change.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to continue that and then stop the FICA deduction until you got to $250,000, because Obama said, you know, no taxes
right
on anybody under $250,000, apparently, they could double the benefits and reduce the age of retirement to 55 the next day.
Hmm.
And if that were to happen, some people would keep working because they just like their job. But
right,
a whole lot of people would go, double the benefits and Medicare, I'm out of here. And that would open up the job market, all the 55, 65, 70-year-olds who've been staying there just because they have, you know, otherwise they don't eat or they lose their health insurance, they would be gone, and the job market would open up to a staggering degree.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these youngsters who, you know, got a degree in this, that, or the other thing, and are flipping burgers at Burger King or whatever, all of a sudden the job market would open up, and I think that might go a long way to curing not only the unemployment problem, but it would also put these an awful lot of people in a position to where they could, you know, bargain for what they're worth. Instead of
right
taking, you know, the scraps from the table,
sure,
of our
sure
well-to-do brethren.
Well, you're absolutely right, Chris. But the chance of that being enacted by this Democratic president or this Republican Congress. I don't know if it would take an act of Congress. I have no idea. I know the president has an awful lot of power by executive order, but anyway, I hear you. Thanks, Chris. Good points. 877-996-2556 if you want to join in. Did I mention this hour is being sponsored by Bruce in Los Angeles? I think I did. Or as he's known on eBay, Oompa underscore Wonkaville. What? Okay, sure. You know, there is an effort to remove from various state laws the prohibition of carrying guns into public schools. And this comes from Indiana. A teenage boy was shot this morning at Martinsville West Middle School in Martinsville, Indiana. A Martinsville Police Department spokesman said that the suspected shooter, a 15-year-old boy, who is also a student at the middle school, is in custody. The suspect had reportedly been suspended from school 2 days earlier. The victim was shot twice in the stomach and was transported to Methodist Hospital in Indianapolis by helicopter. WRTV is reporting that he is in stable condition, at least when this came in this afternoon. I don't know what it is now. The shooting apparently took place near the school's cafeteria and may have stemmed from a fight between two eighth grade boys at a school dance last weekend. The suspect, whose identity cannot be confirmed, posted a note on his Facebook wall this morning before the shooting. He allegedly wrote, "Today is the day." Now, you remember, don't you, Truth Seeker, when you were in school, when you were in middle school, if you got into an argument with another student and it got real serious, you and the other student would probably meet behind the school or someplace off of school property. In our day, it was just meet on the school property and duke it out until the coach came out or the principal came out and put a stop to it. It didn't make any difference if you were a boy or a girl. That's usually the way you dealt with it. But the NRA and the gun-crazy people, they want everybody to carry guns in school. Because the theory being, if the kid who did the shooting, if he would have known that he was in a school where other people had guns, you know, other 12 and 13-year-olds, then he might not have pulled out his weapon. Doesn't that make a lot of sense to you, huh? Sponsored by Bruce in Los Angeles. His message is keep it lit. He's also known as Oompa underscore Wonkaville on eBay. He writes, "Mike, you need to stay on the air or I will just simply die." Thank you. Thank you, Bruce, I guess. And thanks to Alice at Heel and Hollers and Russell and you for tuning in. We do appreciate it very much. Jean is in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Hey, Jean.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
I don't know by Monday what will be going on with that reactor in Japan.
No, nobody does. I don't think anybody even in Japan knows.
Very troubling. It's been 2 weeks, and the information isn't clear. Even though radiation is cumulative. We get up and down readings. It's a very strange thing. Nobody seems to talk much about that MOX fuel in those reactors, and also in the nuclear waste spent rods. That has a half-life at 2 million times greater than just the regular plutonium, because it's very high in plutonium, because they've reclaimed old waste.
Right. Yeah, the idea with the MOX fuel was to try to go ahead and use plutonium, because that byproduct of the generation of nuclear energy is deadly. It's the most deadly substance on Earth, I believe. That's what I was told. And so that's what makes the, I think it's the number three reactor, so incredibly, unspeakably dangerous right now, is that it is fueled by uranium and plutonium. And it's hard to keep thinking about this. You know, I remember when last April, was it in April or May, when the eruption occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. And day after day, week after week, the oil was just pumped, just millions upon millions of gallons.
Yes. And the oil obfuscation was pumped as well.
Right. And now we have the floor of the ocean, according to a biologist here at the University of Georgia, the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico is dead. And when you think about this thing in Japan that's been pumping radiation into the environment, the water off the coast, the earth, the air, for two weeks now, just a steady stream of poisonous, deadly, death-dealing radiation. And I can't believe that this is happening.
Well, it will have an effect, because 20 years ago, I mean, people don't even talk about the effects that we've already had. 20 years ago, I was watching it a lot when China was still doing above-ground nuclear bomb testing.
Mm-hmm.
And the West Coast here received enough radiation at that time to affect the reproduction of wild birds. They were doing studies, and it was evident that there had been an effect, because the pattern of the fallout could be measured. As the clouds would go over the coastal mountains and the Rockies, the rain is dumped in greater quantity on the west side of the mountains.
Right.
And the results were then that there was a decrease in the number of young birds hatching, but mostly on the western sides of the mountain ranges. So this kind of stuff, you know, nobody talks about it, but there are effects, and I don't know what to say. I'm just flummoxed.
Yeah, and I wonder what the conversation is in your part of the United States. You know, the experts keep telling us that the fallout, that's not the right term, I guess, the radiation, dispersed radiation that is from the particles that have been picked up and blown across the ocean in the upper atmosphere, those particles that are radioactive, that there's no danger. That's what the EPA or whoever, I don't know whose job it is to tell people there's no danger from radiation. But then you stop and think of what occurred in the desert in the 40s and 50s in the desert southwest in Nevada test flats, where people were told, don't worry about it. Soldiers were exposed to it. The population would feel the earth shake, and then find out later in the day or the next day in the newspaper that there'd been another atomic test. And the number of people in the United States who have died as a result of those tests, maybe 20 years down the road. But, you know, how do you draw a cause and effect when something happens 20 years later? That's the problem.
Well, no, they draw it by denying this cumulative or glossing over this cumulative reality.
You know, I wonder,
because it is cumulative. The stuff that they're already measuring coming over here is the iodine, the cesium. They all have these long periods of time that they are still radiating. And they're building up constantly all the time.
The thing I've wondered with the apparent, and I don't have any numbers in front of me, so I may be totally wrong on this, but with the apparent rise in not just breast cancer, but other cancers, within the general population of this country. And then you think back, what was going on with the atomic testing 60 years ago, 50 years ago. If there was some kind of a distributed genetic deformity caused by the radiation that apparently just saturated this country, and now it shows up two or even in some instances three generations later in all these cancers, because nobody seems to be able to understand where this is all coming from. And it is so horrifically, stupefyingly horrible. It is. Gene, I got to leave it there. Thanks for checking in. Well, I hate to leave you on such a negative down note, but that's where we're going to leave it. I'll see you Monday, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are.
Jay Farner here.